From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, the GOP candidates for governor hold their first debate.
They all did a very good job of talking to a very specific group of Republican voters that tend to vote in off-presidential years.
The loophole in the state Senate's Medicaid work requirement bill.
The Senate has a kind of moral imagination to think about the way that rural residents of the state might have a hard time meeting the work requirements. But they don't seem to have the same kind of moral imagination when it comes to our city dwellers.
Crowns of courage, henna tattoos, helping cancer survivors heal.
You know, it was so special because it was the first time in a long time that I had felt beautiful.
How German attitudes helped sink the unhappy marriage of Daimler and Chrysler.
One of the things I learned over there is that American, as an adjective, was synonymous with second grade.
Those stories and more today on Stateside. Hello and welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. On today's program, we hear what henna tattoos, crowns of courage, can do for women who are coping with cancer.
My hair falling out, the nausea. And just for those few hours, I was just able to sit still and relax and just remember who I was again.
That comes up later in the hour. But first, the four Republicans who want to be your next governor held a debate last night in Grand Rapids on Wood TV. This was the first time Attorney General Bill Schuette, Lieutenant Governor Brian Kelly, State Senator Patrick Kolbeck, and Saginaw obstetrician Dr. Jim Hines were all together on one stage. Let's break down the debate now as we say hello to Republican strategist Matt Marsden. And we should note, Matt is not affiliated with any of the campaigns. Hey, Matt.
Hey, how are you today?
I'm good. So overall impressions, did anything surprise you last night?
No, nothing really surprised me. It's just four individuals that seem to pretty much be all pandering to the primary base. And I think their positions on the standard issues of Second Amendment and education and one of note would be that their focus on the auto insurance side of things as being a major issue for this is kind of an interesting thing to hear. But I saw four gentlemen that seemed to have spent quite a bit of time in politics with the exception of one, and they all seem to be speaking to the same audience, which is their primary base voters.
So when you look at that range of issues that they were asked about, from marijuana and education, Flint water crisis, environmental concerns, jobs in the economy, as you say, auto insurance reform, guns, did any one of those four set himself apart from the group in terms of policy positions?
I think that the marijuana issue was interesting because I think you had all of them saying, listen, I'm going to support the will of the voters, but I'm opposed to it. I think that the reality of this being on the ballot is going to be far more significant than they were giving it credence yesterday. And given the turnout models, especially with the gerrymandering ballot proposal being on as well, in addition to marijuana, I think you're going to see an uptick in voters that are turning out for possibly more down-ticket-based issues than worrying about who's going to be elected. And I think it was also interesting from the standpoint that towards the end of the debate, they had a lot of conversation about trying to find new revenue streams to the tune of $700 million or wanting an income tax cut. Well, if you're going to look at recreational marijuana as a potential likelihood, you might want to consider the revenue stream it's going to generate and what it can do for the areas that they're touching on. I think the next one was, I was a little taken aback by their position on education and especially Dr. Hines' position that, third grade reading is so low that he wants to put volunteers in the classroom to assist our public education teachers who, if memory serves me correctly, a lot of these public teachers have spent lots of money at the request of other Republican governors, namely John Engler, to receive master's degrees to educate our young children. So I think their positions and some of the education issues were a little bit off the mark.
The candidates were all trying to out-Trump each other in their support for the president. Attorney General Schuette was repeatedly touting his endorsement from the president, and he called out the lieutenant governor for withdrawing his support for the 2016 election. And then Dr. Jim Hines weighed in.
Brian Kelly did withdraw his support from Trump, several weeks before the general election. I'm so sorry he did that. I was so disappointed. Bill Schuette, Trump was not his first choice, but not by a long shot. He campaigned against Trump. And so there's a little bit of hypocrisy here.
Now, I can understand why aligning with the president helps win the primary, but what about for the general election?
I think it's a horrible position to take. I was surprised, frankly, that they were so eager to jump on that endorsement wagon and to out-Trump each other, because I really think the problem with the debate last night, in my opinion, and I always look at the general election, and I understand the primaries well enough, but there are five of these individuals that are running in a primary. They're going to split up a lot of the base vote. I would be having an eye on trying to be a little bit more centrist and appeal to the general election voters, because I'm telling you, it's going to have an impact. And whether or not the Republicans are still supporting Trump in Michigan or not remains to be seen. But to be that eager to jump on that endorsement, you know, may not play so well in the general election. But, you know, I could be wrong. I've been wrong before.
Now, speaking of Dr. Jim Hines, he is, safe to say, the least widely known of the four. Did he say anything, do anything last night that you think might help raise his profile among Republican voters?
I think that his, you know, I think the claims to the religious, you know, right groups, the conservatives, the church, the seven children, I think he's playing to a certain base. I think that Patrick Kolbeck will attempt to play off of that base as well. And so, you know, the Republican primary base voters are diverse, but I get it. But the Second Amendment and God and country and all this other stuff is great. But what's going to happen when they have to stand up against one of the Democratic candidates and have a larger conversation about some other issues outside of guns and education and auto insurance? I just think that it's a little bit of pandering, I guess, to put it politely.
Senator Kolbeck is certainly also working to raise his polling numbers. Here's how he pitched his approach to addressing Michigan's environmental concerns.
Well, you know, my work on the International Space Station was actually, I was responsible for the environmental control and life support system. And you want to talk about a fragile ecosystem, nothing like living in a tin can up in space. And so I have an appreciation for a lot of these environmental concerns. And it's given me an appreciation for the fact that, you know, you sometimes have to prioritize what are the most important effects that you have to address first. And as governor, one of the things I'll do is go off and put together a prioritized list based on the number of lives that are actually impacted by a given contaminant.
You know, Matt, a lot of election watchers, a lot of pundits think this is a two-horse primary between Kelly and Schuette. So what does Senator Kolbeck have to do if he's going to really mount a challenge to these two?
I think he has to diversify the message a little bit away from being a rocket scientist and space shuttles and space stations. I think that's an important part of his background, but I think he needs to talk a little bit more specifically about what he wants to do in terms of public education. I think his position on education is probably not going to be all that appealing to voters in the general election. I think that he has to, you know, really work his base hard. Again, with this being a five-way primary, it'll be very interesting to see how the percentages break out. And to your earlier point, it is a two-person race, and I think you saw that in the barbs between Kelly and Schuette that came right out of the block. I think that, you know, you had the Lieutenant Governor Kelly using two of his rebuttals right away within the first 40 minutes of the debate to counter a point that Schuette had made. So clearly these two are going toe-to-toe. I think it's just a matter of how much can Kolbeck peel off, and can he maintain a percentage to remain relevant? I think it's going to be a difficult course to haul. But again, having Dr. Hines in there is going to change the dynamic in terms of percentage of votes needed to eke out a 21% or 22% primary victory.
If you've just joined us, we're breaking down last night's GOP gubernatorial debate that happened in Grand Rapids as we talk with Republican strategist Matt Marsden. And to your point about the lieutenant governor and the AG, there was certainly a sharp tone. In fact, we certainly heard it when it came to Flint water. Let's take a listen. We're going to start with Lieutenant Governor Brian Kelly.
I want to make it very clear that the Flint water crisis has been politicized. The Attorney General has used it as though it is some kind of launching pad for a campaign for governor. The people of the city of Flint deserve to have an investigation that is apart from politics.
And here's part of Attorney General Bill Schuette's response.
This is about justice. This is about accountability. And if I didn't have this investigation, I would not have been doing my job. I took an oath, and that's just what I'll do.
So he called the lieutenant governor's criticism of his Flint water prosecutions the, and I'm quoting him here, the height of arrogance. Matt, what are your thoughts on this line of attack for Kelly? Is it sticking?
No, I don't think it sticks. I think this is a tragic issue, and I think it was a serious mistake for the state of Michigan and other elected officials to have this happen in the first place. I don't know that you ever really want to run a campaign based on an issue of this magnitude. I understand where General Schuette is coming from. It is his job to look at this as Attorney General, you know, and if for the lieutenant governor to say that, you know, he's not politicizing it by talking about how he set up an office and stayed in Flint and had to pay Flint city taxes, certainly is touting the fact that he was on top of the issue from the beginning. I don't know, from the White House correspondence dinner at the last line talking about Flint's water not being clean. I just don't know how well this is going to play or should be a platform issue for Republicans.
Hmm. Yeah, and I guess it's clear because the tone was so zingy, we're not done hearing that.
Oh, no. I think that we're going to hear more and more of it. And again, I think that probably at the end of the day in a general election, people want to hear about solutions. People want to hear about how we're going to avoid things in the future, not who did what to fix the problem that was part of the administration that Callie is a part of. You know, it's a difficult road for both of them. And again, the attorney general has a job to do, even though he's running, and his job is in part and parcel to take a look at what happened in Flint and are there things that need to be addressed criminally and otherwise. So I think I think we're going to see more of that, but I don't know how important that's going to be to the general election.
You know, Matt, through the debate, there were a number of times that Mr. Schuette referenced Gretchen Whitmer and the Democrats. Is he kind of dismissing the other GOP challengers with his eye on November?
I certainly, in my notes, put that down as noting that he kept referencing Whitmer. So, I mean, I think he's assuming that would be his opponent. However, if you look at the current ads that are on TV right now, we're not seeing a lot of Gretchen Whitmer ads. We're seeing some, obviously a lot of Shree ads and some Abdul ads, but we're not seeing a lot of presence right now from Gretchen. But clearly his internal metrics must be indicating that he sees her as the most viable candidate. And, taking as early shots at her as he can, but it certainly shows you where his eye is. It's not necessarily on the primary opponents on the stage with him, but looking down the road to the general.
Final thought, can you call a winner from last night?
I don't know that any of them were winners from last night. I think it was the first debate of the season, and I think that they all did a very good job of talking to a very specific group of Republican voters that tend to vote in off-presidential years.
Republican strategist Matt Marsden, who is Director of Public Relations and Government Affairs at Rev6 Data Systems. Matt, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you very much for having me.
Michigan Radio sports commentator John Eubacon has covered lots of different sports for lots of different media outlets.
Sports is not really about sports. It's about us. It's about our values. It's a prism to see character displayed.
And today he'll talk to us about his latest book, a collection of stories and essays about sports written between 1992 and 2018. Stay with us. That's in about 10 minutes. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. 20 years ago this week, Germany's Daimler-Benz AG acquired Chrysler. The Germans described it as a merger of equals. Detroit News business columnist Daniel Howes looks back at that unhappy corporate marriage. Daniel, you use words like miserable and bad dream. Why?
These guys never got along from the jump. They didn't like each other. They foisted this idea on Detroit primarily and American shareholders that this was a so-called merger of equals, and it was no such thing. It was an acquisition, and it took an interview with the Financial Times about 2 years after the deal was closed, in which then-CEO Jürgen Trump basically said, I did what I wanted to do, but I had to do it in a roundabout way, i.e. that Chrysler would become a unit of what was then Daimler-Benz. And he and his communications people had foisted this big lie on the world about what the deal was. Now, people who knew the industry knew exactly what it was, that it was an acquisition, and that they were trying to bolt this company together. And frankly, if he'd had his way, the stock symbol wouldn't have been DCX, it would have been DCH. Like my own initials, actually.
Yes.
And the H was going to be Honda. That was the vision. Obviously, never happened. But that was the vision, was having a North American, a European, and an Asian automaker under the rubric of a powerhouse German company.
And throughout this, quote, merger of equals, mm-hmm. that was actually a takeover, what came of it?
Nothing. I mean, I think ultimately you could argue that the greatest legacy of that whole tie-up was the bankruptcy of Chrysler. Within less than 2 years after the Germans unloaded it on Cerberus Capital Management, which is a private equity firm out of New York, the company was in bankruptcy.
Tell us why the Daimler acquisition of Chrysler failed, in your words, because it was genetically incompatible.
Well, you know, Mercedes is an exceedingly proud brand, and you know, you may feel that just being an average American living and working in your communities and seeing the people who drive Mercedes, but you ain't seen nothing until you go to Stuttgart and you see how integral that is to its entire identity. And there was no way, I think, fundamentally, that German engineers who had spent their entire careers honing and crafting what Mercedes was, there was no way that they were going to either A, share components with Chrysler brands, or B, have some of their technology underpin some of those Chrysler brands. There was a plan at one time to take last generation transmission technology and put it into Chrysler. So they were going to be getting generation old kind of stuff.
I remember that, yes.
But they didn't want part of it. And as I point out in today's piece, one of the things I learned over there is that American, as an adjective, was synonymous with second rate. Mm. American technology was second rate technology. I mean, they wanted no part of it. And they tried to integrate it, and there were integration teams and all sorts of other things, but it was very half-hearted. And by the way, it's important to point out that the entire American leadership that was in place at the time of the merger, within a couple of years, almost all of them were gone. They were pushed out one after another, after another, after another. I think a lot of these guys just threw up their hands and said, you know, I don't need this. Either that or they eventually got sacrificed in one way or another. And that was really, I don't think there was any interest in cooperating and actually building this integrated company on the German side. And I think the Chrysler people over time got beaten down. And it's been a very cautionary tale. I mean, I looked at a lot of other tie-ups that followed later and was very skeptical of them because of what I'd seen with Daimler Chrysler. A great example is Renault-Nissan. I thought, oh, this is going to be a joke. And I remember talking to people at the time saying, it'll never work. The French and the Japanese, are you kidding? Well, the difference was, number one, the management in terms of Carlos Ghosn and his worldview. And I think the second one, as I've come to appreciate, is that the Japanese leadership in Nissan knew they didn't have any other options. If this wasn't going to happen, they were out of business. And then fast forward to Fiat Chrysler.
Yeah, and you say this is the sweetest revenge.
Yeah, I mean, their operating margins are getting better and better. And I think they were on par with or close to par with General Motors this past quarter. Sergio Marchionne says we're going to beat both of them. Our operational gearing is moving forward. He's a lot more, I think, open and trying to be inclusive. And he's got a management team that is very international, has a lot of Americans on it who play very pivotal roles. They're not just playing bit parts. I think it's entirely possible that his successor could be a former Chrysler person. We'll have to see. I think it's also entirely possible it could be a Fiat person. So it's just a different way of doing things. And I think the way that the culture, the German culture too, doesn't, I say in the column, one of the things to learn here is that those guys, at least, those German executives didn't play well with others. It was their way or the highway. And that was the culture in that company. And ultimately, you see where it led them.
Detroit News business columnist Daniel Howes. Daniel, thanks.
Thank you.
Week after week, month after month, year after year, John U. Bacon has brought his take on sports to us right here on Stateside. And John has shown us his straight-talking gift of cutting to the heart of the story, making us understand the struggles, stumbles, and triumphs of those people on the field, the court, the rink, a lot more than talking about just wins and losses. John's latest book is a collection of his stories and essays written between 1992 and 2018. They cover a dozen different sports for a dozen different media outlets, from the Detroit News to the Ann Arbor News to right here on Michigan Radio. The title, The Best of Bacon, Select Cuts from John U. Bacon. Great title, John, tongue planted firmly in cheek.
Of course, we managed to get past bacon bits somehow, so...
Well, now you write that you didn't want this book to be a greatest hits collection. What did you want when you were choosing stories?
We obviously want these to be among the best things I've written, obviously, but we wanted to be more than just a chronological boom, boom, boom. We wanted to tell a story in itself. And so we broke it down into six categories, kid stuff, things you do as a kid, including my fifth grade baseball coach, Coach Mack, as well as the kind of games we played back then that you should not be playing today. And that'll resonate with people 50 and older, I think.
Yeah, I mean, throwing bologna up on the ceiling.
We'll get to that one, yes. It's called the bologna game.
There you go.
There you go. Confessions of an Idiot, where I try out for various teams, like the Detroit Viper hockey team, the U.S. Open golf tournament, the Detroit Grand Prix race, of course, car race, and none of it went very well. Stars like Gordie Howe and Joe Louis and whatnot. Then we've got leaders, Bo, Tom Izzo, Carol Hutchins, etc. Legends like the Gipper. Mm-hmm. And you read that one. That one is one of my favorites. How President Hanna Made Michigan State. Ernie Harwell, of course, people you can't forget. And the Money and the Madness, that's where I get in my soapbox and let it rip.
And we've seen you do that.
Yes, you've seen me do that. We start out with a story about my dad for Father's Day, and we close with a story about my son and what I want for him.
Well, we learn a lot about you and your family in these essays, and perhaps just what pushed you towards writing about sports. Tell us the role that you write about in A Father's Day Gift, that the role sports played in getting you and your dad through your sullen teen years.
Sure. There's a great line from City Slickers, you might recall. Well, Daniel Stern delivers it, and he says that when he was in high school, all that connected him and his dad was baseball. They could always talk about baseball. And I was probably a more sullen teen than the average one.
We find that hard to believe.
Well, ask my parents. And my parents are very friendly people, so I'm sure that was disturbing to them. We had Ernie Harwell on when we were driving. We had George Kell on and the TV at home. And we could always talk about the Tigers. And that kept us connected, I think, during that time. And before that, of course, my dad, he played baseball and golf and was decent. Not a great athlete, but a good one. Certainly he was part of my baseball life and so on. He didn't know much about hockey, but he did know that losing is okay, loafing is not, that you had to learn how to be the best guy on the team and the worst guy on the team, and either way, suck it up and keep going. You play the game hard, you play it fair, and that was certainly a part of the values there. And if you do lose, you get over it. You have to suck it up. So,
in fact, you write about lessons you've learned for your adult life from what your dad did when you were cut from travel teams. You didn't get the starring role, and he did?
Nothing.
No angry letters to the coach.
No face-to-face meetings. Yes. Welcome to the old school.
Yeah.
In the spring league that year, I was the second leading scorer in the league and did not make either the double A team or the single A team the following fall. Not that the spring league is automatically a springboard to it, but it seemed like I was getting screwed, basically, and might have been. I came to my dad and said, you know, this is an outrage.
Not fair.
And of course, you're 14. And dad said, yeah, you're right. Period.
And that taught you what?
It taught me that life is not fair, and we don't control these things. You control your effort. You don't control the results. And when you take a hit, you keep going. So I ended up being captain of my house team, and we were city champs and got to the final eight in the state. And I made the high school team the next year ahead of a lot of the guys who were on the travel team before me. So it all worked out fine.
You write about it gave you a tool in your emotional toolbox for when you grew up and you decided to start writing.
Oh, yeah. Look, I mean, college rejections, got a few of those, of course. But more importantly, when I became a writer, freelancer from age 24 on, I've got files, Cindy, of the glorious rejections. I've got them categorized into different levels of rejection. I'm a connoisseur of rejection. I could wallpaper this room very easily with those rejections from magazines, newspapers, and whatnot. And if my dad had not taught me what he taught me in ninth grade, I'm not a freelance writer now. You couldn't do it because the rejection level is so high. You have to take a punch in the nose and keep going, keep going, keep going, and believe in yourself anyway. And that's there aren't too many better lessons than that for somebody growing up.
So you played sports growing up. What'd you play?
Baseball and hockey.
Okay. And then you've coached.
Yep, baseball and hockey.
And you write about in The Best of Bacon, you coached women. Who did you coach and what did you learn from that experience?
This book hopefully goes back and forth between the lighthearted and the serious and whatnot, but I coached the Huron High School hockey team, boys, and I coached the Michigan Women's Club hockey team.
Okay.
So a few years apart, that's one difference there, of course, but anybody tells you it's the same is not paying attention. The women, you're always trying to tell them. I didn't realize what a big deal confidence was, because these are good athletes. They've made the college team and whatnot. But you always have to pull them up on their confidence. You have to say, look, you're better than you think you are. Individually, you tell them this. As a team, you tell them this. Look, that team over there is no better than you are. All right, so let's bring it up. Let's bring it up. Let's bring it up. The boys, you're always telling them, you're not half as good as you think you are. Kid asks, you know, why I'm on the third line, coach? Because I like you. You should be in the fourth.
So you had to learn to adjust for the women.
You have to learn how to adjust. And one of my lines in the book, of course, is that how many women does it take to shoot the puck? And the answer is five. One to shoot the puck and four to say, it's okay to shoot the puck. The boys shoot, shoot, shoot. The women pass, pass, pass. Okay. And I finally figured out, years too late, of course, that I was always trying to get the boys to play more like the women. And I was always trying to get the women to play more like the boys. Boys, I wanted to get more communal, more team-oriented. Women, I need to get a little more selfish, a little more aggressive.
Interesting. I'm going to give you story titles from the Best of Bacon, select cuts from John U. Bacon, and give me a nugget from your book about that story, The Voice of the Tigers.
Ernie Harwell, one of the finest men I ever met. Forget the sports, forget the fame. I met him in Lakeland, Florida in 1996, and I sat down there watching a pickup game. He sat down right next to me. He invites me out for dinner. We have dinner with Lulu, his wife, and Ernie, and we stayed in touch ever since. One of the sweetest men I've met. When I wrote an article that he had come out and said, I'm dying of cancer. And I wrote the article for you guys, as well as for Ann Arbor Chronicle and some others. And I got a call half an hour later from Ernie Harwell saying, John, thank you for the letter. It meant so much to me. And I'm thinking, man, you should be talking to somebody else right now. Time is tight. And then he says, you know, John, we go back a long way. And we went back at that point, you know, 15 years or so. That's nothing for him. He had lifelong friends. To see a man like that behind the scenes, as good as he is in front of the scenes, meant a lot to me.
William Clay Ford, misunderstood man.
That everyone assumes, with the Lions fans, they never wanted, of course, under him, that he only cared about the money, didn't care about winning, etc. No, both are completely false. They invested a ton of money into that team. They never were cheap on the coaches and the players and so on. And his competitive spirit, he was the captain of the tennis team at Yale. He picks up golf, ends up being a scratch golfer in no time. That's a competitive person. So he got a bad rap. The weakness he had was he had a weakness for nice guys who finished last. And that goes back to the family history and his long-running feud with Hank the Deuce, his older brother, who was frankly pretty mean to him. So he wanted to be the good guy helping out a guy like him.
Yeah, I was very, very moved reading that story and realizing the kind of treatment he suffered at the hands of his brother.
And how he responded so well to
yes,
it.
Yes, yes, indeed. How Coach Mac changed my life.
Coach Mac. Mac McKenzie. Fourth grade, I'm picking dandelions in right field. I am the worst player on the team. I'm batting last. And coaches change. The next year, Coach Mac is our head coach now. And all of a sudden, I'm batting first. I'm the team's leading hitter. I'm the captain of the team. I'm the starting catcher. And I'm telling you right now, Cindy, I did not become that much better a baseball player in 12 months. It shows you what a coach can do. And one reason why I've always been attracted to coaches, coaching, half my stories about coaches, Coach Mac, because it changed my life. It truly did. And the sweet part is I had no idea where I ended up after sixth grade. Turns out he's in Arizona. Didn't know if he's still alive or not. We published the story in Yahoo. And I get a letter back a week later from the guy in his 70s after a heart transplant saying, John, I've done a lot of things in my life. Nothing made me feel better than this. And that brought tears to my eyes.
I'll tell you, it's a great story. Travel team madness.
It is madness. We have kids on vans going 3 or 4 hours at age 7 or 8 for soccer and baseball and hockey. It's nuts. And the point of that article for NPR, I wrote that one. Is we're doing this wrong. You get better at your sport by playing your sport, not by being on your in a van going to your sport. Interviewed Yogi Berra for that. And Yogi Berra told me years ago that he and Joe Garagiola, back in the Italian section of St. Louis, would have 40 at-bats by lunch. And his grandson plays travel team baseball, and he, you know, you drive 3 hours for 6, 7 at-bats, and you drive 3 hours back. He said, you know, play the game. Don't drive to it.
What I want for my son.
Yeah, this may had to make me really dig a little deep, and what do I want? And it occurred to me I want about what I got out of this for him. I want him to know what it's like to be the best player on the team sometimes and sometimes be the worst. To fight through adversity, fight through bad calls. Sometimes your teammates are shaky. Don't blame your teammates. Don't blame the calls. Keep going. Take the rejection and keep going. Basically, I want it to do for him what it did for me, which made you, a better person.
Finally, I'm interested in what do you, through the years, you've been writing about sports for a long time now. What's the biggest misconception, John, that people have about covering sports and getting paid to talk to athletes and coaches?
Two things, and this off the top of my head, isn't that prepared? One is that you are a fan. You really can't be. So there's no cheering in the press box. I can't get you tickets. I can't get you an autograph. You're a professional. So you see it more or less as an outsider, usually. Two, as far as the stars go and so on, as I wrote in the book, I don't really care about wealth and fame. Pat Sajak is famous and wealthy. What do I care? What I do care about is talent and character. When you get down to that, the conversations go so much better with these big stars because they're used to talking about their wealth and fame. They're used to the sports writer being starry-eyed and so thrilled to be around him. I don't care. I care about how you got here. I care about what you did. And you start having that conversation, and they open up in a different way than they would just talking about what everyone else already knows about them. If you're talking to Michael Jordan, I know you're famous. I know you're really good. I want to talk about 10th grade not making your varsity team. That's what I want to talk about. And he will open up on those things. So that, to me, is the fascinating part. Look, if we do this right, sports is not really about sports. It's about us. It's about our values. It's a prism to see character displayed. Talking to Michael Jordan, he said, look, I know that curing cancer is more important than what I do. This is more fun to watch. It's easier to see. It's easier to see character displayed, basically. So this book is about values. And really, as you know, it's about the good guys. A few bad guys in here, but almost all of them are really good guys. And how they got here was pretty cool.
It's a great read. The Best of Bacon, Select Cuts from John U. Bacon, who will be at the Ann Arbor District Library for an event brought to you by Literati Bookstore, coming up this Friday, May 11th at 7 p.m. John, thanks so much.
Thank you.
If it becomes the law, Senate Bill 897 would require Medicaid recipients in Michigan to prove they work at least 29 hours a week in order to keep their health insurance. But there is an exemption in this bill that two University of Michigan law professors say is racially discriminatory. That's next on Stateside. Stay with us. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. 2.5 million people in this state get their health care coverage through Medicaid or the Healthy Michigan Medicaid expansion. But the work requirement bill recently passed by the state Senate and now being considered by the House could mean some 100,000 people in the state could lose their health insurance. We're talking about Senate Bill 897. It requires Medicaid recipients to prove they work at least 29 hours a week in order to keep their health care coverage. But there is a certain loophole in this bill, which drew a sharp rebuke in a recent New York Times editorial written by Nicholas Bagley and Eli Savitt. Both of them teach at the University of Michigan Law School. Nicholas Bagley is here with us now. In your words, this loophole is racially discriminatory. Why?
Right. Well, it's not intentionally discriminatory. If you take the bill sponsors at face value, there's nothing in here that says we're going to treat minority communities worse than anyone else. But what the bill does is exempt from the work requirements anyone who lives in a county with more than 8.5% unemployment. And the point is, look, it's not fair to punish someone if they can't find a job. The trouble with that approach is that our big cities in the state are located in counties where the unemployment rates are much lower. But people who live in cities with high unemployment rates, like Detroit, like Flint, have car ownership rates much below the statewide average, have difficulty finding jobs in far-flung parts of the counties, and are going to struggle in a way that places them at a disadvantage relative to their white rural counterparts who are going to be exempted from this work requirement bill.
Now, State Senator Mike Shirky is the lead sponsor of this legislation, and he told Bridge Magazine that rural residents in northern Michigan deserve more leeway in finding a job than urban residents in places like Detroit and Flint. And he said the folks in rural counties lack public transportation that could get them to a job, and their jobs are further away.
I'm not sure that Wayne County is all the much better on public transportation front. The public transportation infrastructure in Wayne County is really limited. The public transportation infrastructure in Genesee County is really limited. I'd encourage the senator to come down to these communities and try to get from the inner city of Detroit or Flint out to the surrounding countryside without cars. What's more, and this is really crucial to understand, car ownership rates in these rural counties that would be exempted from these bills are upwards of 95%. Whereas in areas like Detroit and Flint, car ownership rates are, you have like 75-80% at best. And the people who don't have cars are often the very people who are eligible for Medicaid. Why don't they have cars? We have an auto insurance crisis in this state. Auto insurance rates are through the roof, and they're especially high, sometimes 3 times as high in our cities. So I don't think it's fair to say that rural residents have it easier than urban residents. I think, if anything, the reverse is true. But the important point here is that the Senate has a kind of moral imagination to think about the way that rural residents of the state might have a hard time meeting the work requirements. But they don't seem to have the same kind of moral imagination when it comes to our city dwellers. And I think that's a problem, and it's a problem that breaks along racial lines.
And, well, thinking of legal problems, what do you see here as far as possible legal problems?
Yeah, the Civil Rights Act of 1964 includes Title VI, which says that the recipients of federal funds, and that includes the states that administer Medicaid programs, they can't discriminate on the basis of race. And importantly, that doesn't just prohibit intentional discrimination, overt discrimination. It says, actually, if you adopt neutral rules, rules that seem like they're fair on their face, but have a disparate impact on minority groups, that's not allowed. And that's exactly what we have here. We've got a rule that looks like it's fair on its face, but which has a racially disproportionate impact. And that's a problem from the legal perspective.
Could you see the court stepping in if this gets all passed and is signed into law?
Yeah, I could absolutely see the court stepping in. The key here is that Michigan has to ask for permission to impose work requirements from the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services. And when the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services thinks about this waiver, it's going to have to explain why the waiver is consistent with Title VI of the Civil Rights Act. And if HHS is unable to offer that explanation or offers an unreasonable explanation, the courts can intervene and say, no, you got to go back to the drawing board and adhere to your own rules about what federal grantees can do with federal money.
Now, do you have a feeling that the Health and Human Services Department in 2018 will take that move?
Well, I suspect they are going to be pretty receptive to Michigan's effort to impose work requirements. They've already approved four states for other forms of work requirements. But I think the department will have no choice but to consider the racial impact of a request like this. And depending on what it says, Michigan's waiver could end up in a world of legal trouble.
What would be the legal fix that could be made to this bill that would accomplish what sponsors are looking for and hold legally?
Yeah. So there are a bunch of different kinds of approaches you might take to tailor the rule better. You might say the exemption from the work requirements doesn't just extend to people who live in counties with high unemployment, but also to people who live in cities with high unemployment. You could link the work requirement exemption to zip code and employment within zip codes. You could offer more refined exemptions at the individual level. You could take all sorts of different approaches to making sure this bill doesn't have the same kind of disparate impact.
What kind of response have you gotten to the editorial you put in the New York Times?
Generally positive. I think people understand the racial dynamics here in the state. They understand the places that minority communities live versus rural communities. I think folk understand how unfair this seems to exempt one group of people but not extend to the same helping hand to another. State representatives in the Senate have pushed back and said, look, if we're going to ask people who live in rural counties to drive, shouldn't we ask people who live in Flint or Detroit to also drive to far-flung parts of the counties? And the trouble with that argument, again, is different car ownership rates make that a not a viable opportunity for many people who live in our urban communities.
We have reached out to three of the co-sponsors of Senate Bill 897, Senators Mike Shirkey, Senator Phil Pavlo, and Senator Wayne Schmidt. We've offered them a chance to talk about the bill here on Stateside. We have not heard back from them, but the invitation stands. In the meantime, our thanks to University of Michigan Law Professor Nicholas Bagley, who teaches in the areas of administrative law and health law. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you for the invite.
We love it when we hear from our listeners with ideas for stories and people that we should cover here on Stateside. So here is a great tip that we got from Stateside listener George Bollinger, Crowns of Courage. The art of decorating the body with henna is truly ancient. It goes back some 5,000 years. The intricate henna tattoos might be applied simply for their beauty, or they can symbolize passages in life. And such is the idea behind Crowns of Courage. It celebrates women who are coping with cancer by giving them elaborate, beautiful henna tattoo crowns. It began in Grand Rapids in 2016 and became was displayed during Art Prize in 2017. And with us now is the creator of Crowns of Courage, henna tattoo artist Amanda Joy Gilbert. Amanda, welcome.
Yeah, thank you for having us.
And we welcome one of the women who have been crowned, breast cancer survivor Becky Richard. Hello, Becky.
Hello. Thank you so much for having me.
So good to have you both with us. Amanda, my understanding is you were introduced to Hannah a number of years ago working with the refugee population in West Michigan?
Yeah, back in 2010, I was working with both the Lutheran Social Services and Bethany Christian Services, actually going to school at the time for intercultural studies. And I met so many different refugees from different parts of the world and different backgrounds, religions, and saw this art on multiple of my friends. And I was like, wow, this is a beautiful art form that breaks all cultural boundaries, religious boundaries, and really brings beauty on the skin, as well as bringing women together in a powerful way. And I had fallen in love with it. Just, I've always loved art and working with other cultures. So,
who taught you to do it?
I actually had taught myself. I just started applying it on myself. I've dealt with anxiety most of my life, so I always went back to art and using this art form to reconnect with my body and to love myself and to calm myself has been really therapeutic. And so I just continued to practice it on my own and look up designs and start researching it more and more.
And then what gave you this idea of crowning women who are cancer survivors?
Well, was initially trying to get in the hospitals to use it as a form of ministry and healing, and not many got back to me or really knew what it was about. So I had found a salon in Comstock Park called Beautiful You, who give free services once a month to cancer patients. So makeup and hair, massage, all that. And met a few women there who had had to shave their heads for the first time. And it's a really emotional thing for them. And to be able to be there and just be a vessel for them to talk with, to do a personalized tattoo on, and then also just to offer a crown that fit them perfectly on their heads. Because when else are you going to have that or be able to do that? Has been really fun.
And then in the process, I know people wind up with you photograph your crowned survivors. What kind of experience do you create in the process of doing this?
So we first have them come in and share their story with us, and then have a makeup artist come in and do makeup on them, put eyelashes, eyebrows, make them feel beautiful. During that process, we really get to know them as a person and ask them, what is your identity? Who do you say you are? Because we want to apply that onto their skin and put that on their heads or on their arms or write down mantras or Bible verses to encourage them for the next 2 weeks and make them feel bold and strong and beautiful. And then once we do the crown, we'll have a photographer or videographer to capture those moments and, yeah, to share their story.
And you do a big reveal, right? They don't see what you're doing until everything is done, and then there's a big reveal moment?
Yeah, that's the best part. So, yeah, they're not allowed to see the makeup or the henna until we're fully done, and then we allow them to look in the mirror. And it's a really powerful moment for them.
Becky Richard, you were crowned last summer. At that point, where were you in your breast cancer treatment?
Well, I was about 4 sessions into my chemotherapy, and I had had a few months before a double mastectomy. So I was at a pretty low place in my life, and it was an incredible experience just to have someone who just sat me down and wanted to know about me and my life and my family and my journey and my faith. When you are diagnosed with cancer, your world is just swirling around you. It's just a devastating experience, and I describe it like living in a hurricane. And this experience was, for sure, the eye in my hurricane, because Amanda and the other artists were just able to just stop and really take the time and find out about me and get to know me. And it was a definite turning point in my healing.
How did it change for you?
Well, it changed because I was able to step away from all the medical diagnosis and treatments and the harshness of the medications I had to be on, the chemotherapy, my hair falling out, the nausea. I couldn't eat. I was weak. And just for those few hours, I was just able to sit still and relax and just remember who I was again. It was just wonderful.
And then when you had the moment where, okay, Amanda was done, the work is done, and you got to see yourself in all of your henna'd beauty, what was that moment like for you?
You know, it was so special because it was the first time in a long time that I had felt beautiful. People that know me know that I don't have a self-esteem problem. I've always liked the way I look, but chemotherapy really, and a cancer journey in general, just really wears you down physically, emotionally, spiritually. So I was at a low point in my life, and seeing myself with my henna crown, it's really hard to describe. It was a wonderful moment.
And then over the next couple of weeks, while you had that henna crown so visible, what kind of response did you get when you're out and about?
You know, that was really the most amazing part to me. So one example, I was at the grocery store and, you know, I chose to never wear a wig. So I would go about my, you know, days just bald, walking around, and I was pretty used to people glancing at me and then looking away nervously or giving me a look like they felt sorry for me. And that was, with my henna crown, it was exchanged to people coming up to me and saying, "Wow, you look beautiful," or "What is on your head? Is that a real tattoo? Is that temporary? Is that permanent? You look gorgeous. Wow, you're just glowing." So I got all of these compliments, and it really just opened up for people to come and talk to me. And I had these human connections with strangers that I didn't even know. And that in itself just was a nice little boost for me and helped me get through a really hard time in my life.
And we should note, Steve is the artist that also helps you do the crown.
Yes, yeah, he does the henna crowns with me.
And Becky, I know you're on the Crowns of Courage board now, so this certainly has left an impact on you, and you want to help further this work. But we also want to know, where are you now in your cancer treatment?
Well, I am fortunately nearing the end of my medical treatment. I receive my last infusion this coming Thursday, and then I get my port taken out. So I'm looking at possibly one more surgery for reconstruction, but it feels good to be rounding the corner.
Almost like rounding third base and heading toward home plate.
Oh, I hope so. Yeah, I'm ready. I'm ready to take the next step.
Amanda, I know you've got Crowns of Courage. You are officially now a 501c3, so you are a nonprofit. What is your vision for Crowns of Courage? What do you want to do with this?
Well, our vision right now is to stay local and to kind of just grow it slowly. Obviously, we'd love to crown as many people as we can, but it does take the time and finding the makeup artists and making sure we have a videographer and help, because we really want to empower them by giving them a voice and sharing their story and allowing to be an awareness of a leader, of a goddess, and also of their cancer. And we do also do gatherings every couple months with the ladies who have already been crowned. So we create a community where they can constantly meet and encourage one another. And so we'd like to continue to do that. And then eventually down the road to be able to travel to other places and do it more.
How many have you crowned so far?
Probably over 60 people.
Okay. And I suspect there are henna artists that could be listening to you saying, "This is great. I want in on this." So it is the kind of work that could certainly spread. And we'll encourage everyone, you can check out photographs of the women who've been crowned and learn more by going to the website, Henna Crowns of Courage, all one word, hennacrownsofcourage.org. Amanda Joy Gilbert and Becky Richard, thank you so much for sharing this story with us. It is a beautiful story, and these photographs must be seen to be believed. Thank you so very much for being with us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Support for arts and culture coverage comes in part from the Michigan Council for Arts and Cultural Affairs. Today's Stateside was directed by Lindsay Scullin and engineered by Rusty Brock. Stateside's executive producer is Joe Lindstroth. Contributors are Allie Billings, Mike Blank, Mercedes Mejia, and Sarah Leeson. Stateside is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so very much for listening.